listening to Real Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette, episode 68. Welcome to Real Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette. That's me, the podcast that's filled with refreshingly honest conversations about the wonderful mess of being human. More than anything, this show is home to honest conversations between real people. We're not trying to sell you anything or trying to get you to fix yourself or your life or anything like that. Instead, it's a space to just be real, to take a deep breath and talk about all the behind-the-scenes stuff that I personally think isn't talked about enough, like our fears, challenges, and insecurities, our secret dreams, how it really feels to try and make changes in your life, what happens when you don't accomplish a goal, and just the day-to-day truths of being human in a crazy world. As your host, it's so much fun for me to sit down with everyone from athletes, writers, and entrepreneurs to parents, coaches, activists, changemakers, world travelers, adventurers, artists. The list goes on and on. And to then get to bring those conversations to you. And fair warning real quick that this is an adult podcast, which means that we often cover adult topics and use adult language. My hope for you as a listener of this show is that it makes you laugh, think, and just feel less alone. Because honestly, that's all I ever want, to know that I'm not alone. Something else that's unique about this show is that it's now 100% community supported, which means no ads, no sponsors, and no outside influence. Just us, here together, sharing stories. The show is made possible by listeners like you, who have pledged $8 or more per 8-episode season. To do this, we use a platform called Patreon, and not only does your support go toward the funding that we need in order to keep the show going beyond the end of 2016, which means beyond the end of this season, which hopefully will not be our last season, but your support also earns you access to exclusive bonus content. The bonus content includes conversations and interviews with wonderful guests that aren't aired publicly. Plus, you get access to the Squad Pod, a shorter version of Real Talk Radio where the guests are you, the members of the community. And coming in mid-December, there's something extra special happening for those of you who are in the Patreon community. A handful of your favorite past guests will come back to share a Real Talk end-of-year recap, including details about their 2016 successes, failures, and lessons learned, as well as their dreams and goals for 2017. And all of that will only be available to our Patreon support squad. So to get access to that, plus over 20 hours of other bonus content, just go to patreon.com/Nicole Antoinette. That's patreon.com/Nicole Antoinette. And at the end of this episode, you'll actually get to meet one of our community members who joins me for a quick and hilarious game of Would You Rather and shares how great it is to be part of our Patreon community. So if you believe in this Real Talk revolution, like I do, and if you're in the position to be able to support the show, I can't tell you how much that would mean to me. Right now, the show is scheduled and funded through the end of 2016, which means this season, season 8. And if we meet our funding goal by the end of the year, then it will be able to continue into 2017 as well. And you can totally help to make that happen. So thank you so much for your support. And now let's dive right into today's episode. Today, you'll get to meet Tammy Strobel. Tammy is a writer, photographer, and teacher. She created her blog, rowdykittens.com, in late 2007 to improve her writing, share her story, and help people go small, think big, and be happy. Tammy is the creator of A Simple Year, a 12-month course to help you make space for what matters most to you. In 2011, she and her husband, Logan, moved into a tiny house on wheels where they lived full-time for 4 years. In this episode, which I absolutely loved recording, Tammy and I talk about the decade we've both spent sharing our lives online. We discuss online business, setting boundaries, and the damaging myth that everyone working on the internet is making tons of money. She shares stories from the 4 years that her and her husband lived in a tiny house, and I get a hilarious crash course in how to use a compost toilet. But we also talk about deeply personal things, such as body image, alcohol abuse, death, loss, grief, and more. Tammy shares about her dad's illness and death in 2012 and about the photography project that helped her to move through her grief. Every moment of this conversation felt moving and real to me, and I'm so delighted that I get the chance to share it with you. Fabulous. We are good to go. Tammy, welcome to the show.
Yay, I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so happy too. I have had an online girl crush on you for like a decade. So is that a weird way to start a conversation? No,
I love it. But it's so funny because I just found out your podcast maybe a month ago, and I've totally like binge listen to your episodes. So it's really a pleasure to talk to you. I'm excited to be here.
Whenever people tell me that they binge listen, which I'm totally a binge consumer of everything, so I get that for sure. I had some woman recently, I think it was on Instagram, said something lovely about how she had listened to one of the last seasons, listened to them multiple times. And my first thought was, oh my God, she must be so sick of my voice. Like, it's so long.
No, you have a lovely voice.
Oh man, so funny. I always talk about that too with Adam, who does the sound editing and stuff for these. And I'm like, man, you really just have to hear my voice over and over and over. So funny.
Awesome.
So something that I noticed and loved on your website that we have in common is we both have some version of a digital bookshelf or like a book list. It seems like you are an avid reader like I am.
Yeah, I kind of have a problem like with buying lots of books and reading all the time. Although, I mean, there are worse problems to have, right? But I'm definitely a huge reader.
I also found for sure some books in common that I wanted to comment on, particularly Lynn Cox's Swimming to Antarctica, which I loved.
I love, love, loved that book. And I actually got to hear her speak in San Francisco at the end of September. She just came out with a book called Swimming in the Sink. And Logan, my husband, had like a business conference in San Francisco. And I was checking out her website and saw that she was going to be at the Dolphin Club. And it was like marked as a private event. So I was like, oh, I wonder if I could go. So I emailed the Dolphin Club and was like, hey, so I'm a huge fan of Lynn Cox. Could I basically crash the event? And they were like, of course, come. Like, and it was so lovely. They were the nicest people, but swimmers are super cool. So
what did she talk about?
She talked about like basically all of her books, like her experience with publishing and writing, and then just her swims. And it was just really inspiring. And then there was like a long Q&A as well, which I really enjoyed.
I noticed, well, you're a swimmer, right?
I am.
Okay. So I am not at, I mean, I can swim as in like not drown. I know how to not drown. Like, I'm definitely not a swimmer. I'm a runner, but I've read basically any endurance athlete memoir that I can get my hands on. So some of the other ones on your book, Diana Nyad's Find a Way, I also loved. Age is Just a Number, that I'm like, oh yes, yeah, you and I definitely have something in common in terms of these stories of women doing incredible feats of athleticism.
Yeah, I'm totally obsessed with like memoirs of people in sports, like especially women. I find them so inspiring just to keep me motivated. And I just love hearing about other people's lives. I guess I'm kind of nosy in that way too. So memoirs are a good fit for me.
Have you read Ronda Rousey's book?
I haven't, but it's on my list.
I mean, move it to the top of your list. I read it in like a day. Okay. Yeah.
Holy shit. Okay. I'm going to totally, it's okay to cuss on this, right?
Yes. As much as you want. Yes. The whole show is marked explicit. I was like, I might as well just do that to begin with, because obviously, I mean, I could geek out with books. I'll probably wind up sending you an email with some other recommendations, because
I love those
kind of athletic memoirs and that kind of stuff too. But yeah, Ronda Rousey's book's amazing.
Yeah, that'll be next up for me. And yeah, for me too, this year, like reading these types of memoirs has been so helpful, because I had some kind of big health issues come up at the beginning of the year. And so just like being able to read really inspiring memoirs of both like the good stuff and the bad stuff, I don't know, it really helped me. So yeah.
Yeah, I feel that way too about, it's kind of the nature of the whole podcast. Like, I like honest stories, right? So much is the look at this shiny end result that happened to me, right? But like that, I don't find that to be inspirational at all. And I don't know, reading, especially Find a Way, right? Like that just, uh-huh. And for anyone who hasn't read it, it's basically like her, I mean, what does it span? Like 50 years or more or something, this book of her attempts to swim from Cuba to Florida.
Yeah.
And just, I don't know, like what it takes to just not give up. Like you fail and you fail again and you fail again. Like, what is it in you that then you're in your 60s and no one thinks that you can do this, and even your closest people don't support you, and you're like, nope, I'm gonna do it again. And like then to actually do it, I don't know, it really gets me.
Yeah, it's incredible. totally incredible.
Oh, man. Well, that's a fun inspirational note to start on. Look at this.
Yeah.
So you started your site in 2007, right?
Yeah, I did. It was, I think, November or December. And at the time, I was working for a nonprofit, the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And they do really good work. They represent all the rape crisis centers in California and provide like training and technical assistance for victim advocates and also like do lobbying on behalf of rape crisis centers in California. And so at that time, I was the public affairs coordinator at CalCASA, and part of my job was blogging. And I was so terrified of blogging. And so my boss was like, you'll be fine. Like, you've been writing for years. Just I'll show you how to blog and it'll be okay. And so I got hooked on it and then decided to start my own blog. And yeah, it was great because my boss totally supported my efforts. And he was like, it'll be great for you to practice there. And if you blow up your own site, it's no big deal versus like blowing up the organization's website because I screwed up with code or a plugin or whatever. So yeah.
It's so funny. I mean, 2007, I guess, was and wasn't a long time ago, depending upon how you think about it. But that's when I started my blog also. So you and I are basically the same age in internet years.
Nice. It feels like really long in the internet years, you know, like I'm surprised I've stuck with it for so long. But it's been really rewarding in a lot of different ways and challenging too.
I mean, yeah, definitely. And that's something that I super wanted to dig into, especially because, you know, we've both been doing stuff on the internet for essentially the same amount of time. And it sounds like you have stuck with it more, you know, like I've changed things and quit things and got me, you know, and have made a lot of different iterations. And so I'm always curious about other people's like evolution of living and working online, right? Like their relationship with the internet, with social media, with sharing themselves publicly, like for essentially, I mean, a decade is a really long time almost, right? So
it is. It's a long, long time. And it's funny because I think it was in 2010, I basically deleted all my blog archives on Rowdy Kittens from like 2007 to 2009-ish, just because like during that time, I didn't know what I was doing. And like, I wrote about everything from like politics to like swimming, which is fine, but I just sort of felt like, I don't know that this needs to be on the internet. And I'm sure if people wanted to find that stuff, they could, but yeah, so it's like I've been blogging for that long, but not all my archives are still on the internet.
Yeah. So what feels different for you, I mean, now versus 2007, or just I'm curious about kind of the evolution of how you have felt sharing online over such a long period of time.
Yeah, it's kind of a hard question. I mean, I feel like I have better boundaries now in terms of like what I choose to share and what I don't share. Like, for example, I would never write about politics, which it's funny we're talking on election day. But like when I started my blog, I was, you know, part of my job included doing lobbying work on behalf of rape crisis centers in California, which I think is a good thing. So I was definitely like immersed in that kind of political world and wrote about that on the website. But now it's like I wouldn't dip my toes there just because I don't want to. And I don't know. There are just too many trolls and it's not of interest anymore. But anyways, I just feel like I'm more clear about like what I will share and what I won't share and really being thoughtful about like, okay, have I really processed this? Like, is it appropriate to share? And also just thinking about, okay, well, would I want my husband's 93-year-old grandmother to read this, for example? Like, so just trying to be super intentional, if that makes sense. And I feel like I was totally meandering in that response, but
no, I mean, that totally makes sense. It's, I mean, it echoes a lot of how I feel too. I feel like for me, and maybe it's the age, right? For me, like I'm 31 now. So having done this for the last 10 years, like, I feel like your 20s is such a time of just like tumultuous change and stuff in general. So to have been doing life publicly online during that time, right? Like that there's definitely stuff that I shared that I probably wouldn't share now. I don't know. Not, it's not like in a secret keeping way, but I like how you phrase it about boundaries. For me, I think it has a lot to do with my motivations for doing things publicly have changed. Like if I'm really honest, there was definitely a lot of ego wrapped up in it early on, right? Like, oh,
totally.
That I care how many likes I get on this, or, you know, I want people to think that I'm, you know, X, Y, or Z thing. It was like, it was really important to me and very image based. And that thankfully like has faded. I mean, obviously our egos always pop up, but you know, that's probably the biggest difference for me when I look back at early on. Like it was really important to me to be perceived a certain way. And now I don't feel like I'm not relying on the internet for all of my like gratification, if that makes sense. Whereas I think I used to more so.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. And also, I mean, when I started my blog in 2007, I had like maybe 10 readers. And now like I have probably 50,000 to 100,000 people coming to my site each month. And that's not to try and brag at all. Like I just, that's a lot of people. And so like I feel a responsibility to put out stuff that's somewhat professional and really thought out. Whereas before it just felt a little bit more like, oh, I'm just talking to my friends. I don't know, that it's been a hard thing for me to navigate because I don't want to lose that voice of like I feel like my readers are my friends, but then it's like, I don't know all of them, of course, right? So figuring out how to have that like friendly voice, but not being overly professional. I don't know. It's hard.
It is hard. It's even something that has come up for me. And I mean, this is an interesting time for us to be having this conversation because I basically have stopped writing on, like, other than the podcast, this is really the only thing that I'm doing right now. And some of the decision to stop, you know, it went from a blog to an email list, you know, it had different iterations, but I just started to get a lot of negative feedback, which luckily had never happened to me before. Like somehow, I don't know, I went like 10 years without having the like haters and trolls that people usually do. But it was funny, I was just starting to get some, I don't know, some negative commentary or people that had really strong opinions on what I was choosing to do with my life. And I finally sat down and I was like, this is a free email list. Like I'm doing this for free. And if I'm getting more grief out of it than not, I can just choose not to do it anymore. You know, which felt like, I mean, it sounds silly to say that, but you know, you have to balance. Other people are always going to have opinions and but sometimes you just don't have to subject yourself to that.
No, it's so true. And I've definitely dealt with my share of online haters throughout the years. And I've gone through periods where like even now, like I'll close comments on posts or just keep them closed and then open them. And just because like people can be so mean. And then on the other hand, people can be so kind and like loving and thoughtful and so it's definitely, the internet is weird. It's just such a strange space.
It is a strange, it's also strange. And I wonder if this is something that you've struggled with too, since so much of, I mean, your writing is personal writing, right? It's not like you have a blog about a topic that has nothing to do with you and your life. It's like the opposite of that. So I wonder if you have ever felt, I don't know, misunderstood, or like some of the danger of sharing things online is even though everything we share is true, it's only a tiny part of who someone is, right? Like if you write one post about one thing, people assume they really know you when actually they don't have all the complexity, like the complexity and nuance of if they were, you know, a friend in your everyday life.
Yeah, totally. I feel that, especially like when I think about the tiny house and just some of the choices we've made about intentional living. I mean, people just see like one small slice of my life. And even, you know, my book, You Can Buy Happiness, came out like, I guess, 4 years ago now. And, you know, it's a true book, but again, it's only like one slice of me. And I think people forget like, yeah, I'm sharing all this information online, but it's not all of me, you know, it's just like a small part of who I am. And I try and keep that in mind as a consumer of information as well, whether I'm reading a memoir or a blog post or whatever, because there are so many layers to the decisions that everybody makes, you know, like, And there are some things I just cannot write about online because it would hurt other people. It's not appropriate, you know, so just lots of layers. And again, like coming back to that boundary piece for me is super, super important.
That's really interesting to hear you say that it's changed, that, you know, doing this work has changed how you are as a consumer of other people's work. And I don't know that I've ever thought about it, but it's so true because now even, you know, yeah, even we started this conversation talking about those memoirs, you know, whatever, of course, everything in them is true, but it's not all of that person's life. And I'm getting my experience of it. Like anything we read, we filter through our own perspective, right? Or like how it relates to us, or that it's my experience of reading that book might not be the same as someone else's experience. And like I make it mean something, and I kind of hold that person to a standard that then if they change or they change their mind, somehow it like offends me, right? You know what I mean? Like that's kind of what happens. Like we make people into, I don't know. It's, yeah, it is an interesting thing. Like what of our own stuff we place on other people just through their writing.
Yeah. It's really fascinating. So I just try and be careful about my assumptions. And I think, like, at least, like, I spent a lot of years as a victim advocate, and doing that work really changed me on a lot of levels. And just trying to, like, we're always judgmental. Like, but if you can kind of keep yourself in check with those judgments, it's super helpful, you know, just to be like, oh, I'm totally being judgy right now. Like maybe take a step back. And you know, that I think that applies to like consuming content, like whether it's books or blog posts or whatever, and just remembering there's so many more layers to a person's life than what we might be reading about.
Totally. So when you first started the site, what did you want to get out of it? What was your motivation for doing it?
I really just wanted to connect with other people and to share my writing and photos with a small group of people. And that motivation's really held true through the years. Of course, like my tribe has grown, which I'm super grateful for. But I know that if I wasn't writing publicly on my website, I wouldn't be writing or even taking photos. Like there's something for me about the accountability piece of sharing an essay or a photo roundup or whatever on my website that keeps me going. I mean, of course, I'd still be journaling and things like that, but that's like a different kind of writing. It's not like the piece I recently posted about gratitude and good health, that took me like 3 weeks to write, you know, and to try and cultivate something that was good and understandable and had a little bit more depth than just like, how to declutter your house or whatever. the accountability piece has been huge for me.
Yeah, it's so funny. I was having this conversation with one of my best friends this past weekend who also used to blog and doesn't anymore. And we were talking about for me, it's been more recent, but what we miss about that, or, you know, just kind of what leaves your life when you decide to stop sharing, whether it's photos or writing or whatever publicly. And I agree with you completely that accountability piece, I don't know, like, I'm just not going to do it. It's not the same. Or even it's not the same because if I'm writing for myself, it's not necessarily that I'm writing in a different voice, but I'm not looking necessarily for like the moral or the lesson or like really what's underneath. There's something about knowing that other people are going to read it and having to make it hopefully intelligible to other people that it brings out, I think, a better, I don't know, it's better. So, and I already miss that for sure.
Yeah. And I think part of it too is like having to think about the reader and also myself just makes me examine issues in more depth. And I definitely examine stuff in my journal for sure. But like you're saying, it's just kind of a different form. And that's something I really enjoy about blogging. Although I have thought about quitting blogging, you know, it's like, I've been doing this for 10 years. That's a long freaking time. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, does it still, you know, and it's something I've been thinking about recently, like, okay, well, do I still love doing this most of the time? Does it really bring value to my life, to readers, like all of that stuff? And so I don't know. I mean, this year has been so interesting for me, like health-wise, professionally. I feel like there's going to be a big career shift for me, but I've felt like this for the last year, but I don't have answers. And that's so hard because I'm such a type A person and I want the answers, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm the same. Uncertainty or indecision is like my most stressful state of being. And it's really hard when you're in that space where you're starting to question whether the thing you're doing, whether it's like a relationship or a job or blogging or whatever, it doesn't feel quite right anymore, but is it just a phase? You don't know what the next thing is, and it's just, you just have to wait and be patient and like do the self-reflection, and that's mm-hmm. all the advice that I hate, right? Like, I don't want to do any of that stuff.
Totally.
So yeah, I hear you. So I'm curious, why the name Rowdy Kittens?
So totally random. Like, when I was tossing around this idea of starting a personal blog when I was at Calcasa, I was sitting with my work colleagues in our conference room, and I was like, I really want to, you know, start blogging, and I want to write about like downsizing and happiness and like share my photos. And I was like, you guys, what do I name the blog? I have no idea. And so I had like probably 5 to 10 coworkers with me, and they started like shouting names out in the conference room. And someone was like, okay, how about Rowdy? And then someone else was like, Kittens, Rowdy Kittens. And so that's how the name came to be. No strategy behind the name. But like my tagline, go small, think big, and be happy, I think is more an apt description of what I try and share on the internet. So yeah,
that's an awesome story. I love the origin stories of things, especially when they're just completely random. That's amazing.
So random. And I love the name. Like, it just makes me laugh, and I'm a total crazy cat person. So
I am
works.
Also a crazy cat person, so I hear that.
Your kitties are so cute. You should Instagram them more.
Oh, thanks. I know. I should. Although I guess every picture would be the same, because our older cat, like, all he does is just like lay there like a lump, and our smaller cat is too hard to photograph, because as soon as you take the camera, he's like, what is that? What are you doing? Like, well, let me just claw you and be all over you. But
oh my
right.
God,
more
so
cat
funny.
Photos. Noted. So you mentioned briefly the tiny house before, and I would love mm-hmm. to back up into that and have you
sure.
tell me the story of, well, first of all, timeline-wise, like, when did that decision happen in this like blog thing that we're talking about, and just
yeah.
what led to that decision? Because I'm super fascinated with the tiny house life.
Yeah, the tiny house. Love the tiny house. So, okay, let me think. So I started blogging in late 2007, and by that time, Logan, my husband, and I had already started this whole downsizing adventure. Like, basically in 2003, I was working in the investment management industry. Like, Logan and I had just gotten married. I was like so stressed out. We were in debt. I was drinking too much, like, to cope with stress at work, shopping. Like, I was just a mess. And I knew how privileged I was. And I was just like, what the fuck is wrong with me? Like, we have got to make some shifts in our lives. So Logan and I basically decided, okay, we're going to like simplify our lives and just go small, pay off our debt, like change everything so that we can be happy and healthy and really feel like we're contributing to our relationships, like doing work we love, all this stuff. And so like the downsizing began, and then in 2007, like by that time I had transitioned out of the investment management world into the nonprofit world doing victim advocacy, and just kind of like kept going into smaller and smaller living spaces. And around that time frame of 2007-2008, I discovered tiny houses, and Logan and I were like completely obsessed. Because, I mean, we were at that point, we were living in Davis, California, and the like housing is so expensive, and we just knew that we would never be able to afford a traditional home. I mean, and we also didn't want to plop down like $500,000 on a house and be in more debt, you know? So we decided to start saving up for a tiny house on wheels, and we saved for, I guess it was like 4 years for the tiny house. And then in 2011, we finally took the plunge and hired Portland Alternative Dwellings to design and build our tiny house. And then we moved into the tiny house in October of 2011 and lived in the space full-time for 4-ish years. And now we're living full-time in a small apartment in the city of Yreka. So that's sort of like a really quick timeline of the tiny house, but really our motivation behind it was just this obsession with little houses and wanting to live super simply, small, debt-free, and yeah, it's been a total adventure and wild ride with the tiny house.
So when you say tiny, how tiny was your tiny house?
The tiny house is 128 square feet. So it's...
That's tiny.
It's very tiny. It's 16 feet long, 8 feet wide, and about 13 feet tall. And it can fit into like an average sized like parking space for a car. And it has like a sleeping loft. It's like the design is really, I think it's beautiful. And people, like your readers, can check out my website for photos and stuff like that. The hard thing about tiny houses is in most cities, they are not legal to live in full time. And so that was definitely a challenge for us. And one of the reasons we decided to move back into a small apartment, just because where we are now in Yreka, you can't live in like a super tiny house on wheels legally. So that part's been super interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much of the zoning, because I've looked into this just in my like fantasy world in my life. Yeah. Because I mean, it sounds like you and Logan had this in common. There's no scenario, except maybe under threat of death, that my husband would ever want to live in a tiny house. Like, just it just never, 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 never. Which is fine, right? Compromise, I guess. But I've looked into it just for my own fantasy lifestyle. But yeah, the zoning and all of those kind of regulations are really like dependent on the area.
Totally. Like when we were in Portland, Oregon, it was fine. Like we didn't have any problems. We rented space in a backyard, which is such a weird thing to say. I was renting a backyard.
I mean, that's such a Portland thing to say.
So true. And, you know, like we ended up moving back to California in 2012. Yeah, September 2012. My dad had passed away in June of 2012. And we were just like Logan's job had been moved, like was being moved to Boston, and he had the opportunity to go to Boston, but the timing was really horrible. And we were just like, you know, like all the signs were just pointing us back towards California to be closer to family. That way we could support my mom like through the grieving process and for us too. But we kind of hopped around Northern California during 2012 and at the beginning of 2013, and that was super stressful. And we ended up moving back to Siskiyou County, which is the northernmost county in Northern California. Super rural. My in-laws have a beautiful cattle ranch outside of Yreka, and that's where our tiny house is currently parked. And I don't think we'll be moving it anytime soon. So
I'm curious, in the years that you were living in the house, or maybe in the first year, was there anything that came up, either good or challenging, that surprised you? Like, what was unexpected? Because it sounds like you guys saved for years. It wasn't just this complete impulse, wake up one day and buy a tiny house. So I'm sure you had some expectations. And I'm curious what kind of didn't line up to what you thought it was going to be.
Yeah, so... I mean, the tiny house, like we love it, but it was just hard in the sense like there was so much curiosity around it, and just from the blog and then like people like walking by in our Portland neighborhood, kind of like peeking over the fence, like looking at the house and stuff like that. So a lot of curiosity in that sense. And then also, like overall, the design of the house I really like, but one thing that I would change is that where we have the composting toilet, like we did like this idea of like, oh, well, we'll have it like make the bathroom as a shower space too. But in order to turn the bathroom into a shower space, like you literally have to move the composting toilet, take up an additional like a secret layer of flooring off, and then like put a shower curtain around the wood to shower. We never did that ever. And so we ended up showering like at the gym, or like Logan would shower at work, which was fine. And we had kind of planned on that anyways, but just like, I really missed having a shower. Cause the way we designed the space was super, super simple. The composting part, like composting your own poo, Not really into it.
Okay, wait. So I need to know more about this composting toilet. Like, actually, how does it work? Like, what is it? What? Tell me everything about the compost toilet.
Okay. So, well, it's like ours. Okay. If you want to do composting, I highly recommend reading the Humanure Handbook. Super helpful. And Logan could totally go geeky on you with all the science behind composting. I am not that geeky and can't, like, describe it like so elegantly like Logan does, but basically you can turn your own poop into soil, which is pretty awesome if you compost correctly. So we just had basically like the toilet itself was designed really beautifully, but like you just pooped into a bucket and like we separated like the urine and poop so that when you composted the humanure, it was less, it was just better like for the soil. So yeah, like the composting toilet, like in theory, like, okay, sustainable, like whatever, but it was kind of a pain in the ass. And most cities are not on board with composting toilets. Like, for example, when we were in the city of Chico, they weren't cool with that because we ended up getting in trouble with the city because of zoning issues. That's a whole other story. But yeah, that's just not something that cities do with composting.
So, okay, so the bucket is full. What do you do with the bucket that's full?
We have like a separate container to do the composting in. So it's like a huge, huge drum. And I can't remember how many. It used to like these drums that we have to do the composting in, like they're just like giant buckets, I guess, in a sense. And you have to let like the compost sit for a certain amount of time. And then like you make sure you take the temperature, because if it's not like heated at the right temperature, it can literally like explode.
And that's not ever what you want to have happen.
No. And again, like, I feel like I'm doing a horrible job at explaining this, because like Logan is like Mr. Science and like does this beautifully. Anyways, there's science behind the composting, and the same is true for like composting, like vegetables and things like that. Like you don't want it to get too hot, I guess. All that to say, composting, it's kind of a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
So, and especially like in cities, like you just, like, it's not legal in most cities. So that's a problem. And like where the tiny house is now on the cattle ranch, like it's, you know, it's not an issue. And like the way we compost, it's safe, it's sanitary. Like, you know, we're not like exploding things or whatever.
You're not just like covered in poop all the time, right?
No. Okay. I mean, like it's done in a separate area. Like it's safe, it's clean, you know, but it's just another to-do list. Like, item. So
it's right. It's something that you don't have to think about if you live in an apartment with plumbing.
Right. And that's like one thing about tiny houses, like you really need to think about if someone's going to pursue that. Like, what systems are you going to have for your tiny house? Like, is it going to be like a more traditional RV and you'll hook up to a sewer, or like water, like for example, where we were in Portland, or even like in Chico, or like when we were at my mom's place in Red Bluff, like even if we had a traditional shower in the tiny house, like we couldn't use it because it's like, well, where does the water go? You know, mm-hmm. Like these are things you have to think about if you're not hooked up to a traditional system, like in an RV park or whatever. So there's like that different layer of complexity with the potty, showering, all that stuff. And then, of course, the zoning, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that tiny houses are a perfect example of the big difference between the fantasy of the thing and the reality of the thing. I mean, and I know that, too. Like, it sounds like an awesome fantasy for me, but would I feel differently when it gets to like, okay, now I have to compost the poop and figure and shower at the gym and do these kind of, right? That it's like, I don't know. I think that's true for, what do I want to say? I think I've talked about this before on other episodes, but I'm really obsessed with essentially like closing the gap between what we say we want and what we actually do, just like the process of change in general, and how many unmet or unfulfilled goals have to do with the fact that like the fantasy of the thing is so different like than the reality. Like I think about this with running or with any type of like fitness, mm-hmm. like it sounds really sexy, right? Like everyone in the magazines like looks awesome, right? But like for the most part, running's like kind of a shit slog. Like sometimes it's amazing, but like most of the time it's just like sweaty and you're bored and you don't really want to do it. And
yeah,
I don't know. That's like, I think you get what I'm saying, but there's definitely a difference between the like shiny version of the thing versus the day-to-day, and like you have to be cool with and want the day-to-day stuff.
No, totally. And I, you know, tiny houses I think are a great option in terms of like affordable housing to a certain degree. And when you talk about affordable housing, like that's a whole other conversation. And I don't know. In a lot of ways, I feel like tiny houses have been really glamorized. And I've tried to be really honest, like in my writing, about the challenges regarding our tiny house and our experiences, both good and bad, and not making it sound like shiny and perfect, because it's not. Like, there are challenges with the tiny house, like, you know, and the systems that you choose to incorporate in the design and all that stuff. And like, I did a horrid job explaining like the composting toilet. So like, if you guys like really want to learn more, read the Human Manure Handbook, because they'll do a better job. But
you gave us a good overview. Yeah. Hey, I mean, so I'm curious if you guys felt like there were any specific impacts on your relationship from the change in living situation to being in a tiny house.
You know, I really think like the tiny house brought us closer together in a lot of ways. And even just like this whole concept of downsizing in general and living in smaller spaces, because like it's such a multi-level or layered thing, like, you know, with downsizing, like there's the stuff, there's money, like how you spend your time, your relationships, like every area of our lives we kind of re-examined. And being in such a tiny house together, like when we had disagreements, like we had to talk it through. And the same goes, same concept holds true now in our 400 square foot apartment. Like if we're mad at each other or if something hard comes up, we have to talk about it. And in a lot of ways, I think that's really been so valuable for our relationship. And we've been, God, how long have we been together? Like 15 years now. So, I don't know. Like, it's been great for our relationship in a lot of ways. Although Logan, I love him, but he has way more stuff than I do, and it drives me crazy.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with the feeling.
So, you know, yeah. Like, if you don't put your stuff away in the tiny house, it's a problem. So,
well, I mean, yeah. When you have, like, such a tiny amount of space, yeah, no, totally. I mean, my husband's like, the tiny house wouldn't fit any of my bikes. He's like, he's a cyclist, and so he's like, all these bikes. He's like, I can't even, my bikes need their own tiny house anyway.
Yeah.
So, you mentioned before, the tagline of your site, the go small, think big, and be happy. And I'd love for you to talk about what that means to you specifically right now. Like, what does that look like in your life?
Oh, gosh. Right now, I just feel so grateful for like basic stuff. Like, I can walk without pain. Like, it's amazing. Like, so I've had back issues basically since high school. And, I had a really bad flare up in February, and normally when I have back flare ups, like, it's a couple weeks of pain and then the inflammation goes down and I'm okay. Well, with this last flare up, like, it just wasn't getting better. And so I ended up going to the doctor. Long story short, like, they did x-rays and I was diagnosed with a mild form of arthritis and degenerative disc disease. Although I was like, if this is mild arthritis, like, what the hell does like rheumatoid arthritis look like, you know, just in terms of pain levels and stuff like that. So just really being grateful to function like on my own and just like walking without pain, like I can swim without pain, like it's kind of amazing. So noticing like those tiny, well, they're kind of big things, but I think also when you're able-bodied, you kind of take that stuff for granted. At least I should say I have in the past, because you're like, oh, everything's good, like, you know. So at this point, I just feel like if I can be really healthy and strong, that just makes me so happy. And I don't know, that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Well, and I know that you recently wrote about a piece about this on your site about kind of gratitude and good health. And I'd love for you to talk about some of the things that you shared in that.
Sure. Yeah. I've my issues with like body image go like way back. Like when I was a tween, I developed an eating disorder, and basically, you know, for two decades of my life, I struggled with just poor body image, like low self-esteem, like dealing with this eating disorder. And I finally sought help for that in college, and I'm healthy now, and I love my body. But to think like that it took me basically two decades to be okay with my body and how it looks, and it just makes me sad, because I know so many women struggle with this, and it's like I put so much emotional energy into that, and I think, oh my God, like what could I have done with my time had I not been worrying about being quote unquote fat, whatever that means, you know, mm-hmm. and trying to like reach this false ideal of being thin. Like I'm never going to look like one of the women on the magazine covers in the store, you know? And so like addressing like my eating disorder issues and body image issues, and just really focusing on strength, both like physical strength and strong mental health, have been like a huge thing for me, and especially in context of this new diagnosis and trying to stay healthy and be grateful for the body that I have. Like it's the only one I've got. Like I want to make sure I take really good care of it. I mean, I just turned 38 like a couple days ago. And so it's like, you know, I hope I have another 40 years left, and I don't want to spend my time obsessing over stupid shit. Like there are more important things to do, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I felt like that was tangential, but definitely the strength piece has been on my mind a lot this year.
Well, something that you talked about in that piece specifically that really resonated with me, and I'm sure once we start talking about it that we are not alone, is I don't think you use this wording specifically, but kind of the point of being raised almost subliminally to value thinness over health, even while being mm-hmm. told that health is most important. Like that makes me think of, is very similar to how I was raised, you know, with my mother. It wasn't, it's so hard to explain, because I still don't want to throw her under the bus, right? She did the best job she could. But, you know, even her generation, I mean, she was a flight attendant for 18 years back when, I mean, you had to have weigh-ins, and you had to, mm-hmm. you know, like you would get fired if the scale was mm-hmm. too high on that. So, I mean, she definitely had her own, you know, stuff with that, but was on a diet pretty much all that I can remember, right? Like the Nutrisystems or the, you know, Weight Watchers, all these things. And that even though it's always, oh, it's all that matters is that you're healthy, it's then you're seeing, it's like confusing mixed messages that like, it doesn't really matter as long as you are thin. Like that's what matters the most, because that's how I saw her treat herself and, you know, just all of that. And it's, I don't know, it's an interesting, I really related to when you kind of touched on that as well. It's an interesting way to grow up where no one maybe is specifically saying that to you, that that's what matters, but yet you're picking up on that. And then how do you value health as the most important thing when like that's not what's going to give you the most external validation?
Right. And I like, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's just, and I really, it's like my mom and the women in my family, like everyone's doing the best they can. Like we all have the tools in our toolbox, and we're muddling through the world, and it's not easy, but it's like, you can't say to a young woman, like, you know, value your health, and then turn around and like go on a diet, or tell that person, oh gosh, you're so big, like maybe you should lose some weight, or, you know, it's just like, what? And then like seeing my peers like be so focused on being thin, and watching all the images in the media, it was such a mixed thing for me. And like there are more layers than just that came with like the eating disorder, but and you know, it's definitely like not my mom's fault, you know what I'm, I don't want people to think that, but it's, I feel like our behaviors matter more than our words. Like if you really love your body, like show people you love your body by taking actions that like indicate that by like eating healthy, not trying to go on a diet. Like diets don't work anyways. Just so fascinating. Like our culture, like, and it says so much about like how we value women. And it wasn't really until college that my perceptions started to shift, because I took women's studies classes and I was like, oh my God, like this thing called feminism, like it totally changed my life. And having like really deep conversations about that topic with my peers was really, really helpful.
Yeah, I remember this, I don't know why this just triggered in my mind from this conversation, but a couple years ago, so my nieces are basically like college age, right? Like early college age. And it was a couple years ago, and we were at some kind of family function, and there was an adult female family member there who was having, it was some kind of dessert, right? It was like cake or something. It was like very vocally like, the diet starts tomorrow, or I'm gonna, like, was very clearly had a lot of food guilt, right, around what she was eating, but saying the things that, I mean, I think unfortunately are way too common. And I could see my nieces, right, and some of the younger women, like just kind of picking up on that and then thinking, well, should I be eating what I'm eating? Like you could see it happen. My mom and I wound up having a really interesting conversation about, hey, how can we be more careful or extra aware? Because I agree with you that actions matter more than words, but also words matter too. Like what are we modeling for them basically? Right.
And
it's funny. There's just little insidious kind of messages that, or even how other people react at periods of time when for whatever reason, you have lost weight or you whatever, everyone wants to comment on it. Oh my God, you look so good, or you look so thin, or that's something. It's almost, it's a habit that I, right after the years after college, had to, I mean, it's kind of like even embarrassing to talk about. I feel like I had to train myself out of commenting on other people's bodies, because that's just like such a thing that you do. Like, oh my God, you look so skinny, or like that was just such the talk of my peer group, I guess, and having to like forcefully stop myself from doing that.
Yeah, no, I totally like, I completely relate. Like I had to do the same thing. And it was again, like through college and like, oh, like, I mean, it's not, commenting on someone else's body is ridiculous. Like I just, it doesn't really, I don't know. I just feel like it's not necessary. And it can make someone feel really bad. I mean, it was like in my post, I talked about like being so ill and coming back to school. And I was in like sixth or seventh grade, and everyone was like, oh my God, you look so good. And I had lost like 15 pounds and I was still sick. And I was like, what's wrong with me? Like, I look good. Like I've been in bed for 2 weeks and it made no sense, you know? So it's just really fascinating. So I do think like, it's like the words and actions really do matter. And like, I had never seen one of my male family members like stress out about having a piece of cake, you know, like,
yeah,
it's always the women, you know? And so I just think it says a lot about the training we get as women in this culture, from, you know, our parents, our peers, and the media.
Oh, I completely agree. I also, around the time that I was thinking about all this, I had never seen male friends, male family members comment really to each other about each other's body, right? Like they're not complimenting or like making fun of each other's bodies in any way. Like just not a topic of conversation. Like there's other things to talk about, right? And it really made me consider, I actually had to have, speaking of communication, a difficult conversation with my mom. Every time I would go home and visit her, she would always comment on my body positively, but it was always in that, oh, you look really thin, or you whatever. And we finally, I had to be like, no, no more. Like you can't, even if you think that you're saying something nice, like we can't, this can't be a topic of conversation like at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just, it's just interesting. Like having, it was uncomfortable to have to set those boundaries. Cause that's not, I mean, how often in your life are you like, okay, please don't tell me that I look thin, just cause then it starts your mind thinking, well, I don't know. It's just not a good place to be, I think.
Yeah, no. And that's, God, that's a hard conversation to have. So hard. Cause I've done that with, family members too. And, sometimes it turns out well, other times not so much.
Yeah. So. Other times not so much. Yeah. This could be a whole other rabbit hole that we don't have to go down, but yeah, just kind of like, even I think the core point they were both talking about is that it is just, it's complicated, right? And like living as a woman and trying to navigate this space where you're trying to essentially undo everything that you have been, you know, consciously and unconsciously taught. It's really hard.
It is so hard. And, I mean, part of me still feels like, like these twinges of shame that I wasted so much of my time in my teens and 20s obsessing over body image. Like, but I can't go back. You know, I just can, I'm healthy now. Like, I can only like move forward and stay on a positive track. So, we're all on our own journey.
And you mentioned, you know, really prioritizing feeling physically and mentally strong. And so I'd love to hear a couple of things that make you feel that way. Like, what do you do that makes you feel strong?
So definitely swimming. Like, I've been a lifelong swimmer, and one of the bummers about living in Yreka is that we don't have a year-round pool. There's a pool during summer, which is awesome, and I'm super grateful for that. But after my latest back flare-up, I just was like, you know what? I have got to find a way to swim regularly. And so I ended up joining a master's swim team in Ashland, Oregon, which is about a 40-ish minute drive from Yreka. Like, we're super close to Oregon. And so I go up there 2 to 3 times a week to swim with the team. And it's like been one of the best things that I've done for myself all year, because I feel so much stronger. I've connected with fellow swimmers who are amazing. And I also joined the local CrossFit gym about 2 months ago. And that was really terrifying for me to do, because I had wanted to start lifting weights, but I was scared because of my back. I was like, well, like, maybe I shouldn't be doing this, you know? And like, so our cousin Aubrey, this is another long story, but basically she was in a really horrible bike accident in February, and she is having to relearn everything again, like walking, talking. Like, it was a pretty severe.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. She, has a brain injury. Like, she had 3 strokes when she was in the coma, and we just got back from Florida visiting her, but she's made so much progress and is so inspiring. And she had started going to CrossFit, and she was saying on the phone that CrossFit had been more helpful for her than physical therapy. And I was like, well, if Aubrey's doing CrossFit, maybe I could do it. Like, maybe these folks aren't as crazy as I think they are. Cause like, I was totally stereotyping CrossFitters. Like, the imagery that I see online is just like people doing these crazy things with super, super heavy weights. And, after my conversation with Aubrey about CrossFit, she was like, dude, just call the local gym, see if they're a good fit, and give it a try. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do that. And they're an amazing group of people. Like, the classes are super small. My coach is just so kind and helpful, and I feel safe. Like, I don't feel like I'm going to get hurt, because, and I think that's because the classes are small and they're so focused on good form and safety. Whereas if I had tried out a bigger CrossFit gym, I don't know that that would have worked for me. Like, I don't think I would have felt safe with my physical issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about on the mental side for you?
Counseling is rad. I've definitely I found a really, really good counselor in Yreka probably about 2 years ago. And I worked with her probably just under 2 years. Like, I'm not seeing her right now because I just feel so good. And I'm so grateful that I found her, because I was able to really talk through a lot of issues about my dad and his death and just kind of family dynamics. And it was kind of like a lot of unresolved grief that I hadn't dealt with. And I just feel like therapy and counseling is so good. Like, it's so important to take care of your mental health, because if your mental health isn't good, I don't know if you can be physically strong. Like, it goes together.
Yeah, so much. And this is definitely something that I feel like has come up, but I'm going to come up in other conversations, but I'm going to bring it up again because I believe it so strongly. I think one of the, how do I want to say this? I think both in terms of what we're talking about body image or disordered eating or mental health, I think it's so easy to downplay a struggle that you're having, or I can talk for myself, struggles that I'm having, if they aren't at the extremes, right? Like, oh, well, I'm not anorexic, so probably this is not a problem. Or, oh, I'm not so depressed that I can't leave the house for a month, so probably this isn't a problem. Like that there's such a spectrum of, I don't know, there's such a spectrum of all these things that you don't have to be, you don't have to wait until it's complete rock bottom situation in order to benefit from asking for help.
Yeah, totally. I mean, when I found my counselor here in Wairika, like I wasn't in a space where I felt like, oh my God, I'm at the bottom or whatever. I just knew that I needed some help. Like I had unresolved issues that I needed to talk to someone about other than Logan, like someone outside of my little bubble of people who are all awesome. But I feel like there's something to be said for seeing a trained therapist that can really help guide you through more intense problems, because friends can't always do that, and they might not have the skills to really help in that way. So, God, I mean, even like the recent election has been so traumatizing for so many people. Mm-hmm. And if you need to see someone to talk about that, that's okay. Like, I just feel like seeking help with whatever problem that you've got is so important. And I don't think people ask for help enough.
Yeah. I also think there's, at least for me, I kind of had a false belief that if you ask for help, let's say it's in the form of counseling, right, or whatever, that then you're going to have to do that forever, which also isn't a bad thing. Like if you do mm-hmm. wind up working with a counselor for a really long period of time, that's not bad. But it's oftentimes I have found help to be a relatively short-term thing. Like the help helps and then you move on. I don't know that mm-hmm. It's almost like I project forward too much into thinking, okay, well, if anything that I start, that's going to have to be forever. And that's really never the case.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't have to be forever. It could be like a month, you know what I mean? Just to like get you through. And that's totally fine, you know? So, and the thing I loved about my counselor is it's like, I don't know, she's like just such a great mentor and advisor for so many different facets in my life. And even like, so for example, I read a book called Drink by Anne something, what's her last name? Damn it. But anyway,
I know exactly the book you're talking about.
Okay. So you can link to it in the show notes for people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool. So for me, that book was so transformative, and it was also really scary because I saw so much of myself reflected in her story. And I was like, am I an alcoholic? Do I drink too much? Like really asking these hard questions and having those conversations with my therapist. And she's like, no, you're not an alcoholic. Like, yes, in the past you have drank heavily for sure. But like she has training in addiction issues and all this stuff. So like being able to talk with her through that stuff was super helpful. And what I realized was like, well, alcohol doesn't really make me feel good. Like I don't want to drink right now. It's just not, it doesn't serve me. Mm-hmm. And like being able to recognize that and just stop, I think is good. And then also being able to ask for help and to really like go through those questions is super important, I feel, at least for me. And also just like alcohol in general, like it's everywhere. And I guess I didn't really realize that until I decided, you know, like I don't really want to drink right now in my life. Like I'm not saying I'll never drink again, but drinking definitely hasn't served me this year. Like if I have a glass of wine, I have a headache the next day. So what's the point of drinking? Really,
I mean,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, preaching to the choir, like for sure. I am so glad that you brought this up. It's one of my favorite topics to talk about. I did in May, I did kind of a special edition episode of the podcast because that was my 5-year soberversary. Mm-hmm. And so talking about all this kind of stuff. And I feel like, first of all, that book is great. Like I highly recommend it to everyone. But I love what you're speaking to. It kind of echoes what we were talking about before, that I think like the best, I don't know if definition is the right word, but definition of self-respect is exactly that kind of inquiry process that you went through, that you don't have to be, you know, a classified alcoholic. You don't have to meet a certain set of criteria in order to stop doing something. Like, you can just ask yourself, like, is this serving me? Is this more self-destructive than not? And make changes based on that. And that's something that leading up to me quitting drinking, I struggled with a lot, because it was the same thing. I'm thinking, well, I'm not waking up in the gutter after 3 days and not remembering, you know, where I came from. I'm still going to school. I'm still having a job. So probably I'm fine. What am I making such a big deal about? But it doesn't have to be this like rock bottom to be really not serving you and to, you know, ruin your life in other ways. That it's okay right. to just make changes without, I don't know, we don't have to meet a certain set of criteria in order to decide to just stop doing something.
Totally. And like asking yourself those hard questions and like being able to just be really honest is so important. And for me, it's like alcoholism runs in my family. Like, it's a big issue. And I know I have an addictive personality like that. Like, I tend to just like get super obsessive about stuff and like go for it. And that can be both like really good and really bad. I think like there's two sides to any coin, right? And just like, I don't know, like the booze just doesn't work for me right now. Mm-hmm. And it's been interesting, like people's reactions around that. But I think it's more about like, not what I'm doing, but it brings up stuff for them, which is
100%, 100%. I went through that as well. I mean, to your point too, about once you took a step back from it, noticing, well, you know, whatever you said about alcohol being everywhere, the messaging around it, that was hugely impactful for me. I think, was it last season, maybe two seasons ago, I had Holly Whitaker from Hip Sobriety on the show.
Oh, I love her.
Oh my gosh, awesome. Right? Following her on Instagram has actually been really helpful for me to uncover some of this more, again, like subliminal messaging. Like, she'll retweet or like post on Instagram and call out some of this messaging of like how heavily, you know, wine or whatever is marketed to women as this like, mm-hmm. oh, it's wine o'clock or it's Friday and like you deserve this or you can't get through, you know, the weekend without whatever. And it's just, and she like lays it down and calls companies out. And I, through that, have become more thoughtful of, oh, that's so, it's like the food stuff, right? Like, how, what are we doing as women? Like, this is the culture that we are like, in order to be sexy and fun, that you have to be a drinker, right? And yeah. that there's, I don't know, like I've definitely come up against and thought about that a lot in the last few years.
Yeah, me too. And something too, like with the book Drink, I really liked how she shared her personal story kind of like in that memoir form and also had so much research to go along with it, because I didn't, it's sort of like, you know, duh, like alcohol's a drug, you know, and, but it's marketed as being like, oh, a glass of wine or two a night is good for you. But actually that might not be true. And the research backs that up. Like, it really is dependent on your body type, like how much you weigh, all this stuff. And that kind of was shocking for me. And I was just like, how could I not like have more of an awareness of this, you know? So it's just been a really interesting process for me this year in terms of like really looking at my health and everything from like the workouts I do to like what I'm eating and drinking, et cetera. Like, it's just been, I think, a year of change on the health front, which has been really good.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it. And I don't know. I also think these things, it's always an evolving process, right? What we need any given day or month might not be the same 6 months or a year from then. So it's always like having to pay attention to yourself in real time. And what do I need? Is this working? You know, what would make me feel stronger or better or whatever, you know?
Yeah, totally. Totally.
So you mentioned one of the reasons that you sought out this particular counselor at that time was to process the grief about around your dad's illness and death. And I would love for you to share anything that you're comfortable sharing about that. I know that photography was a big part of the healing process for you, and I'd love to hear more about that.
Sure. And when I say my dad, I'm talking about my stepdad, Malin, and he was really like, I mean, my biological dad and I, we've kind of had like on again, off again relationship through the years. And we're not like super close, which makes me sad, but that's a whole other story. But Malin, really was like my dad, and, he was an amazing person. And so he had a massive stroke in January of 2012, and then another stroke soon after that. And those strokes left him cognitively and physically impaired. And so 2012 was a really interesting year in the sense that it was filled with a lot of professional highs. Like at that time I was writing my first book, You Can Buy Happiness and It's Cheap. And that came out in September of 2012 after Malin's death. And so it was like those first 6 months in 2012, I was spending half my time in Red Bluff, California with my parents, helping my mom take care of Malin, and the other half of the time in Portland with Logan in our tiny house and trying to write my book and kind of just get through. And then we ended up moving later in 2012 after Malin's death. And I just kind of, I felt like I was on like this, like I was keeping myself so busy, like that I wasn't dealing with the grief. Like, and so when we finally landed and things got really still, I kind of fell apart. Like it just, it was so hard. And I didn't expect that because I was like, well, I knew it was coming. Like I knew he was going to pass. Like, and on the one hand, there was like this feeling of relief because he was no longer in pain. But then on the other hand, it was like, oh fuck, like, nothing is ever going to be the same. Like our family unit kind of exploded. Like all these issues like came up that I didn't really realize were there. So there was that too. So I did a pretty good job of like trying to keep myself so busy I would have to avoid like dealing with a lot of the grief. And so I ended up starting a photography practice called My Morning View, and it was January 1st, 2013, I think I started the series. So every day I take a photo of my view and I include my coffee cup in the frame, and I do that as a way to just honor Malin's memory. And I also started the project just to like do something positive to kind of get myself up out of bed and to really just to try and be grateful for the tiny, beautiful moments in my day, because I was having such a hard time like seeing them because I was so sad. And it's like crazy to think it's been 4 years-ish since I started that project and he's been gone for that long, but it was definitely really, really helpful. And it wasn't till, let's see, 2014 probably that I found my counselor in Yreka, and I was really, I think, able to address some of the issues that I needed to dive deeper into and just give myself permission to be sad and to cry and to kind of fall apart a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much in there that's beautiful that I want to comment on. First of all, the Morning View project. I mean, that's, so you're still doing that every day.
I am, yeah.
And it's following you on Instagram. This might be really weird feedback, but it's so peaceful. I don't know. Like there's just something about this project specifically that, I don't know, I love it. Like it just, it's like a little moment of like, oh, like these lovely leaves, or that, like I feel that like simple moment of gratitude like come through these photos. So as just an outside perspective, I'm like thrilled that you're still doing this.
Oh, thank you. That's really kind. I appreciate that a lot.
And you know, what do I want to say? I think one of the hard things, if I'm talking about my own experience of any kind of grief, for me has been dealing with other people's perceived timelines of when you should be, quote, over it. And I'm worried, I'm like, I'm interested if that ever came up for you.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, I feel like, I mean, even like 3 months after Malin died, I kind of got this, like no one said it like overtly, but just sort of like, well, are you over it? It was just your dad. Like these subliminal kind of comments. And I don't think people were trying to be mean necessarily, but I also think that it's just really uncomfortable for folks to see someone that's really sad and they don't know how to deal with it. And like, at least in my experience, like, just being there and listening and not trying to fix it has been great. Like those friends, if that makes sense. And yeah, I mean, it's like, like I said, like Malin's been gone for 4 years and I still, like, as we're talking about this, it's like, oh, my throat's tight. Like, I want to cry because I miss him. Like, it's never, that's never going to go away. But on the other hand, like, I want to honor his life because he gave me so much, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think your honesty is beautiful. And I think that it's really empowering to hear someone be honest about this. I've been thinking a lot lately about, and I don't know if this is just the way I grew up. I don't know if this is American culture in general. But I feel like I was never taught in any circumstance, like how to deal with some of these like deeper, darker, I don't know. We're like not taught how to grieve or how to mourn the same way that I feel like we're not taught, and this might be more superficial, or I was never taught like how to end a relationship, right? Like if you're dating something, sure. Like, yeah, I was never taught like how you, so I didn't, I was, I mean, this is a segue into a different kind of different conversation, but that I let relationships, you know, romantic relationships drag on way too long, or like did shitty things to end them, or like I was never taught how to wrap something up with grace. And I feel like the grief side of things, I don't know, we're so uncomfortable with that. Like you said, uncomfortable seeing other people being sad. We want things to just go back to this, you know, whatever the status quo is, that there's just, I mean, I have no answers. It's just like complete no answers at all. But there's definitely something there that we don't, or I like, I'm still uncomfortable with it too. Like if someone's upset, I want to fix it. Or I want to, you know, to your point that it's just listen, just be there, just be present. It's kind of like my problem with, I think, our like self-helpy obsession with happiness is like, essentially, happiness is an emotion. And if you're glorifying that as the ideal state, then it's almost like anything else that you're feeling that's not that is bad and has to be pushed away, when like it's normal to be sad, right? And
yeah, totally. I mean, and it's sort of like you can't really, I don't think, be happy or joyful or grateful if you don't experience the suffering. I mean, it's like that's something that like my counselor talked about again and again with me. Like, it's not all sunshine and roses. And I know this. Like, I mean, other bad things have happened to me other than Malin dying, you know, but it was just, I don't know, like he was such a unique and amazing man, and like not having him around sucks, you know, but on the other hand, I'm so grateful he was part of my life for 20 years, like, and that I had a step parent who was like, no, I'm your dad. Like, you know, it was like he asked my permission to marry my mom and was like, if you don't want me to be your dad, you know, I'm not going to marry your mom, and that's okay. Like, I want you to be honest with me. And it's like, who does that?
Yeah,
you know?
That's incredible. Yeah.
I mean, he just so kind and thoughtful, but, yeah, just like, it's funny because, ever since Malin passed, I've basically wrote probably 3 different books about like loss and like probably 100,000 words. And I've not published any of this stuff because, it's not really, I don't think, fit for public consumption. And I do feel like, if I do write a memoir about loss, I have to figure out a way to do it that won't hurt other family members. Cause I want to be really respectful about like kind of certain circumstances and other people's feelings and kind of the dramas that happened during that time. But it's really hard to write a how to about grief, because I think everybody experiences grief in different ways. And, you know, for me, like finding a therapist and really focusing on photography helped me find gratitude again, find myself, and just like appreciate like small, beautiful moments. But that might not be true for everybody, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and that's why I think your podcast is so great, because it's all about people's stories and not feeling alone. You know, it's like, if someone out there is going through this grieving process, it's like, you're not alone. Other people have been there before too. So like, if you can reach out and find a support group through hospice or a counselor or even a friend that can listen, it can be a life changer.
Isn't it so funny? Like the rampant egotistical nature of how we think that we're such special snowflakes. Like, I think about this all the time. I'm the only one that's ever been this sad, or I'm the only one that's ever like struggled with this about body image or this about money, or I'm the only one that's ever had like sex be an issue in a relationship. Like, just it's just so cute, right? Like, literally, I mean, of course we're all different, but like, we're all the same. Like, you're not special. And like, I mean that in the nicest way, right? I have to tell myself that. That's, I mean, I appreciate that you said that about the show, because that's my entire motivation for doing this is basically, it's entirely like a selfish project of, I need this constant reminder that I'm not alone. In their own way, everyone's going through the same thing. Like, it's just, I don't know, it's like the lesson that I need to relearn, like, basically every 24 to 48 hours. Like, it's okay, Nicole, like, it's so cute you think you're alone, but you're not. It's just oh my gosh. So you mentioned books, or, you know, the potential of, you know, writing a memoir, a book about loss. Were there any books that you read, I don't know, during the last 4 years or so, that you did find helpful or comforting that you would want to recommend to someone?
Yeah. There's one that I really love. It's called This I Know, and it's by Susanna Conway. She lost her partner, gosh, I think it was 8 or 10 years ago, and he had a heart attack and died suddenly. And so, that book is just so beautiful, because I feel like, she doesn't try and sugarcoat like the pain that goes along with grief or loss, but she does a really good job of like sharing her story. And also, I think, just offering like practical creative tips that people can try. And also, it's more than just about like grief. Like, she talks about like her business and other like stuff that came up because of the grief she felt for her partner's passing. So I love that book. It's really the only one that, because I read a lot of books about loss and grief, and hers was just one that really resonated with me.
You are not the first person to recommend her to me, so that will get moved up my list. Absolutely.
Yeah, she's amazing.
So, switching gears a little bit and circling back, I know we started the conversation talking about, you know, sharing online business. And I'm curious, given that you have been, even with, you know, maybe different boundaries, sharing yourself online for such a long time, what's something that you, like a misconception, or like, what do you think is something that would be easy for someone to think about you who just knows you from, you know, social media or your blog, that maybe isn't true?
Oh gosh.
Or like, maybe how you think you're perceived. I don't know, something in there I'm interested in.
I don't know. I mean, the first thing that I thought about was like, I'm definitely not rich because I have an online business. Like, working for myself is really hard. And I've thought about like closing up my shop. So like, I get really tired of the narrative of like, let's all like get rich real quick by starting a blog, because that's not true.
That's not how that works. Right.
And I don't know if like people really like think this when they come to my website, but it's really just something I've been thinking about lately. Like, I get really annoyed with some of the, I hate to call it like propaganda, but it's just like, the online business stuff, it's really challenging. And I don't know that you're going to make like $200,000 a year doing like a blog with online courses or whatever, you know, if that makes sense. And also, like, the other facet that we touched on is like the tiny house, like, this idea that like, oh, like, you live in a tiny house, like, your life is perfect. And of course, I don't live in the tiny house full time anymore. And, my life has never been perfect, and I've tried to be pretty clear about that with my writing. But those are just kind of two topics that I thought about immediately with that question.
The online business one, I mean, I feel like I want to do a whole series of conversations that's kind of like the truth about money, right? Or just like for each different person, especially with kind of like the smoke and mirrors of the internet. Not that there aren't people that have wildly successful businesses online. Of course there are, right? But I think it's kind of like the body image stuff. It's like we're supposed to be thin without caring about being thin, right? And I feel like this is the same thing where like you're not really supposed to show how much money you're making online, but it's supposed to seem like you're super successful. I don't know. There's like a lot of imagey stuff in there that it was funny for me when I decided on this funding model for the podcast, right? Because I experimented with sponsorship, like which was fine until I ran out of companies that I was like, oh, there's only like two companies that I'm totally obsessed with. And now that I've worked with both of them, I have nothing else that I can promote with my whole heart. So I guess that's done.
Yeah. Damn.
And yeah, well, and also just, it's funny you mentioned how before that, you know, your online stuff changes how you are as a consumer of things. Like I'm hyper aware when I listen to other podcasts and there's just so much advertising. Like I fast forward through it, or even I've unsubscribed to certain shows because I'm like, stop trying to sell me stuff, right? So if I'm sensitive to that, why would I make other people do that? But switching to the crowdfunding model, I don't know, that even just at like entering into this conversation that, well, money has to come from somewhere, right? Like
yeah,
things
totally,
cost money. So
totally.
And like that it feels weird to even be having that conversation of like, there's just, especially on the internet, this, I feel like we have an expectation of unbelievable high quality content for free all the time.
Yeah. And it's a lot of pressure. I mean,
oh my God,
it's like what you're saying, it's like, you know, my website, it costs money to maintain, like at a core level, you know, like if people want to read my stuff, like I have to front money to do that. And regardless of like, if I have a business based on the website or not. And when I decided to leave my day job and kind of exit the victim advocacy field and do my own thing, I had a really nice savings account. And I did that intentionally. We had like $30,000 in the bank. And had I not had that cushion, I wouldn't have left to start my own business because, you know, and I've talked about this like in past posts, but it's just like I needed that safety net because, you know, just because I want to do this online thing doesn't mean it's going to work. So making sure that was in place was super important. But like I've been doing like my own thing since January of 2010. And like my low income has been about 20 grand gross. And then the highest has been about 50,000. So, you know, definitely I'm super grateful for that. But like self-employment, like, you know, no health insurance, like you have to buy that yourself. There's no like unemployment, like, yeah. So it's just, it can be tricky. And like even this year, because of my health issues, like Logan's been the primary financial support for us because I just didn't work very much the first half of the year because I was in so much pain. So I don't know. It's been challenging.
Yeah. I mean, and I think, again, it's like neither of us have like any magic answers for anything, right? Which is like, which is awesome because nobody does. But
nobody
that I think
does.
Just having this conversation, and I'm like, whether it's around money or anything else, but like the money stuff, especially, I think, I mean, we all have money things, whether that's from childhood, family of origin, right? Or like outside perceptions, whatever. But it's, I've thought about that a lot too, like since switching, you know, I had an online business for three and a half years that I wrapped up for, you know, which wasn't the right fit anymore. And when I decided to start the podcast, kind of on the heels of that as the next creative project, the only way that I was able to do that without going out and getting another full-time job was because my husband's salary is enough for the lifestyle that we live, right? And some people don't want to hear that that's the answer. That's not the like ass kicking woman, whatever. Like people had opinions about that even, like,
I know,
you know, and for me, it's like, well, what's, is it better if I just don't say anything? And then like the people are sitting at home thinking somehow that I've managed to like make six figures from this podcast, which is like so not true. I don't know. Like I would always rather hear what's true for other people.
Oh, totally. And I think it's so important that like you're honest about that. And that's why I try and be honest about where I'm at too, like on the money front, because I don't want people to necessarily assume things about me, like particularly with the internet stuff and like these ideas folks have about like online business and success and all that. And it's been interesting for me this year to like let Logan just support me. I mean, my business, I'll probably gross like 20 grand this year, which is, you know, I like if I were by myself, I'd have to get a job. Like, let's just be real. but I'm really fortunate because my, you know, Logan supported us. We've been very intentional to save money and have an emergency savings fund. Like Living Simply has enabled us to do that, you know? So, that's another facet to the money stuff. But, like I supported Logan during grad school for years, but for me, like just this year, I'm like, God, I don't feel like a real feminist or a strong woman or whatever, because I'm not able to make like 40 grand or whatever. And it's just such a weird thing. Like, why do I have to be so hard on myself about that? But money is a constant thing I have to work on for myself.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, you guys have been together a lot longer than Paul and I have. February we'll be married 3 years. And I feel like the biggest, you know, if they say that, you know, being with someone who challenges you or who teaches you about yourself, it's not even as much about him as a person as it is about just marriage has brought up so much money stuff from my childhood mm-hmm. and past that I thought was resolved that like clearly was not resolved. And I mean, it's been wonderful. Like, honestly, I feel like some of the best self-growth that I have done in the last 3 years has been around this, like around money. And after having essentially worked and paid for myself from like age 15 or 16 onwards, right? And then being in this situation where, you know, he doesn't want to maybe have like as small or downsized of a life as me. So, okay, that's going to mm-hmm. cost more. So, okay, he's going to pay more. Okay, I'm going to do this creative project, which doesn't bring in as much money. It's just so funny, the stuff that comes up once it gets into money. And then people don't want to talk about that because I think there's a lot of like shame and discomfort around it.
Yeah. And it's like, with body image issues, like, I feel like with the money stuff too, it's just something culturally and, you know, with grief, like we don't really talk about it. I mean, I think the conversation is starting to change a bit, but, yeah, the money stuff is interesting. And I definitely think like Logan and I, like Living Simply and really like having so many conversations about money. And really, I think growing up together, like we started dating when we were like 21-ish. So in a sense, I feel like we've grown up together like through our 20s and now like we're both 38. And so it's been like constant conversation about money and like trying to be mindful about spending and saving and all that stuff. But it's been so good. Like you're talking about like just that growth of really having to have deep conversations with your partner.
Well, and also to then have to address like what baggage and bullshit you're bringing into the relationship yes. about this kind of stuff. Because when I decided to wrap up my business, because a lot of elements of it really weren't making me happy and wanted to start the podcast, like I had so much guilt around, okay, I'm not going to be bringing in money for a while. And then once I am, it's going to be less money. And like, he had no issues at all. He's like, we have plenty of money. Like, what are you, it's fine. You know, and it was just so yeah. funny. We honestly had the same conversation. I'd say 15 times is an underestimate. Like I just like kept needing to be like, are you sure? And he's like, these are your own issues. We can talk through them, but like, I'm fine. It was really kind of talking through that principle of that things don't have to be equal in order to be fair. Right. That like,
right.
I don't know. I remember I read really a couple months before we got married, maybe it was earlier than that, some article, some like listicle, something online, which are usually kind of vapid and not great, but it was this one about someone mm-hmm. who had been married for, I don't know, 15 plus years or whatever. And it was like her 15 like lessons on marriage. Right. And mm-hmm. it was actually fantastic. I should find it somewhere and like put it in the show notes if I could ever find
That'd
it again.
Awesome.
And one of them that like really hit me and really stuck with me was this idea that, you know, when you're in a partnership, right? Like whether it's marriage, a monogamous partnership, if that's something that you value, right? If that's your relationship, that you guys are a team and no one else is on the team and no one else needs to understand the team's rules. And just like something in that space that really came up a lot with this money stuff. Like if I can get over my own issues and work through that with a counselor, with whatever, and like, if we're fine, it doesn't matter what anyone else thinks about how much money I should be making in correspondence to him or mm-hmm. how we should be saving. Like, literally we're a team and it doesn't matter what anyone else thinks. And I don't know. I totally. Go back to that a lot.
No, that's such good advice. And I feel like so true. And like, I totally just resonate with everything you just said, just because it's like with me, it's like Logan's like, dude, we're fine. Like you supported me for years. Like the least I can do is like get you through a transition, or like maybe next year your business will explode and it'll be great. But if not, like how privileged am I that I get to like think about this, you know, and like think, okay, what's next for my career? You know, like not everyone has that choice. And I just feel like so grateful for that. And that I have a strong marriage and partnership, and it's amazing. I'm just so grateful.
Well, I mean, I think the answer, if there is one, is what you just said, being able to shift into a place of gratitude for it, because that's a lot of what happened with us too, you know, and a lot of it was, you know, really him talking to me about, he's like, I have this job that I absolutely love. The market happens to arbitrarily value it higher than other things, or, you know, like that even is arbitrary. It doesn't mean anything. It's not like what, you know, he said, it's not like what I do is more valuable than what you do with the podcast. It just is different. And like, this is where like the money is. So like, it's just pointing out a lot of like how we make something mean something doesn't have to necessarily be about that, but it is like money brings up a lot of issues of like worth and stuff. So being able to switch into that place of gratitude and realize like the unbelievable privilege, yeah, has been helpful for me too.
Yeah, no, it's so important, because I definitely, it's like I'm very aware of how privileged I am, and like so grateful, you know, and not in the sense like, oh, I'm grateful for my privilege, but just like I understand like the poverty that's in this world, like the violence, like violence against women, like there are so many intense things happening on the planet, and I feel like my problems are just so tiny in comparison, you know? So it's like all in perspective, I guess is my point.
Yeah, I mean, for me, something that I have been working on intentionally, it was one of my goals for 2016, is to stop creating fake problems for myself. Like meaning like to stop making something into an issue when it doesn't have to be an issue. I'm real good at that. Like I could be an Olympic gold medalist at like creating fake problems out of nothing. And like, it's just, yeah. And I think, again, it's funny, like the answers that I never want to be the answers, like, well, go back to gratitude. Like it just sounds like such like this hippie woo woo, but like it works. It really does work.
It so works. Like it's amazing. I've been doing this journaling exercise every morning. It's called Start and End Happy. And I can't remember. I watched a TED talk by the woman who started doing this, and she went through a lot of like rough stuff. Like both her parents died. She got cancer. She was hit by a car, like got divorced. Like it was pretty epic.
Oh my God.
And she started doing this journaling thing, and she would do it in the morning and then end the day with it. And she would ask herself like, okay, today I'm grateful for, then today I helped someone by, and then the third one is something that made me happy today is, and then today I learned and tomorrow I will. And so she started her day doing that and ended her day doing that. And the TED talk was just basically about that exercise and how much of a difference it made during a really rough 5-year stretch in her life. And it's just, I think it all comes back to gratitude, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, this something similar came up in another episode this season. I had my friend Drea on, and we were talking about that. Of course, as you and I were saying before, like grief and sadness, like all of those things are real and human and definitely happen. But also there's an element of like, we can choose where we place our focus. And it doesn't mean that you can just choose not to be grieving, right? But I think maybe outside of some of that stuff, like that you can choose to do an exercise like this or a journaling thing like this, that's going to just switch your perspective. You know, whatever amount of our emotions we do have control over, or our worldview we do have control over, that exercising that really will make a difference.
Yeah, totally. And I just think a lot about Mailhan and how amazing he was, and just like, you know, he'd want me to be happy. And I, of course, I still miss him. I get sad, but I also know that I can do things that he would be really proud of. Like instead of getting in a funk, I can go for a walk and like just like do my morning view thing every day and just really appreciate like all the goodness that's in my life.
Yeah, I love that. I feel like that's a great place to start to wrap up. And the way that we end these, as you know, is with what we call community questions. So they're questions that the listeners want me to ask each of our 8 guests of a given season. So there's 9 of them, kind of rapid fiery random questions, if you are down
for
that.
I'm so down.
Okay. When was the last time that you tried something new, and what was it?
Oh, okay. So definitely CrossFit. Like, and that was, I went to my first class on September 16th, 2016, and it was really scary and hard, but I did it and I've been going ever since. So, hopefully like that will continue, but, it's been really good for personal growth. Like there's CrossFit is a whole other world. So it's been fun learning about like weights and meeting new people and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's so funny when you say that, you know, it was new, so it was like scary and hard. I feel like I finally had, this is going to sound really dumb probably, but I finally had the realization this year that there's never going to be a time when something new doesn't feel scary and hard. Like, it's just not going to, I have this like expectation that at some point I'm going to outgrow that. But, like, new things are scary. We like to know what we're doing. We like to be good at stuff. So like anytime you're out of your comfort zone. So I kind of hit this point where I'm like, if I stop waiting for things to not be scary, then I can just get on with it. Right?
Yeah, no, totally. That's awesome.
The next question, what's something that you really love about yourself?
Oh, I think my persistence, like when I latch on to something, I just stick with it and I keep going, like with the blog, like, holy shit, I started blogging in 2007 and I'm still blogging. So, yeah, definitely persistence.
When you're getting to know someone new, what's either a favorite question to ask or what's something you find yourself feeling curious about everyone? Like, what do you want to know?
Oh, interesting. I'm kind of like hobbies. Like I always hate asking somebody like, oh, well, what do you do for a living? Like, cause it's sort of like this question of like, well, how much money do you make?
Or totally.
I don't know. Like, I don't know that everyone wants to talk about their day jobs necessarily. So I'm really curious about like how people spend their time in their off hours. Like, what do they really enjoy? Like, is it reading? Is it CrossFit, running? Like, so yeah. Like,
yeah,
what do you
I
do
agree.
In your off hours?
Yeah, like what would you do with uninterrupted time if you could? Yeah, I love that too. What's one thing that you know now that you wish you had known 3 years ago? So like 2013 you, what do you wish you would have known?
It's okay to slow down and fall apart.
That's such a good one.
Just like cry if you need to cry. Ask for help. Just stop running, basically.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
What's one non-negotiable for you? So one thing, whether it's large or small, that you feel like it's really important to do every day?
Move my body. Like, I have to have some kind of exercise or movement, whether it's like a walk or like a swim. I've just found that like to maintain like both like strong emotional health and physical strength, like I have to move. And I'm just really grateful that I can do that without pain currently.
Mm-hmm. So if I could hand you an all expense paid trip for two right now, where would you go and who would you bring?
Ooh, I think I would go to Amsterdam and I would bring Logan. And because Amsterdam is like bicycle awesomeness, like we have friends, Dave and Trina, that just moved to a little town, I think outside Amsterdam. I think it's Leiden, if I'm correct. But just like that whole region, I would love to explore more.
That would be fun, man. Yeah. With this question, I'm like, I wish I could send everyone on their trips.
I know, right?
So as we head into the end of the year, which I know can be a time of reflection or resolutions or goal setting, what's one goal that's on your mind for 2017?
Oh gosh. So this really kind of goes back to like the online business stuff and money. I would like to have a better sense of what's next for my professional future. Like, am I still going to be doing online business or am I going to let it go and like get a day job again? I just don't really have a good sense of what's next for career stuff. Like, I feel like I'm always going to be creating and sharing my photos and putting that stuff on the internet because it's a good accountability thing for me. But in terms of like the money side of things, I don't know. I want a better sense of like what's next and like more stability, I guess, for my career and finances.
Yeah, you and me both. We can circle back about that next year.
All right.
See how that
yeah,
goes.
Let's do that.
Which two or three books of any genre would you say have had the biggest impact on you or maybe that you reread or recommend the most?
Okay, this is hard because I read obsessively.
I know. It's hard for
as
me
you
too.
Know.
I know.
But I guess like, it's a hard question because I feel like books have a different impact on me at different points in my life. But I will say for this year, definitely the book Drink by Anne Johnson, I think is her name. And I loved Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert. Totally awesome. And I'm actually going to bring up my book list really quick. Maybe you can link to that in your show notes.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
I think also Love Warrior by Glennon Doyle Melton was amazing. I love her writing because she's so honest, and I really appreciate that honesty. I don't think she sugarcoats like how hard life can be, which I think, like you've talked about, being kind of a recovering self-help addict, mm-hmm. and I feel like I'm in the same boat. Like, I just want to read really honest stories, and I just don't know that there's a 10-step formula for nailing life. So, like, if people can be as honest as they can in their writing, I just so appreciate that, and I think she does an amazing job. And then I think the other one would be Find a Way by Diana Nyad.
It's plus, so good.
So those are my books, I think, for the year that have been really, really rad to read.
Well, I will put links to all of those. The last question, when you look ahead at the next few months, what do you feel most excited about?
I feel really excited about swimming, about doing CrossFit, and just like really enjoying like my photography practice and journaling. So yeah, just like movement and then photography, really.
I love that. Just like the day-to-day life, small reflection things. It's so fun.
Yeah, it's fun. And like I said, I'm just really grateful to be healthy. So it's pretty awesome.
So what's the best place for people to find you and say hi online? Maybe like if you have a favorite way to connect on social media, where should people go?
Definitely my blog, rowdykittens.com. You can find me there. And then my favorite social media outlet is Instagram. So, if you guys want to pop over and say hi there, I definitely love Instagram.
I also love Instagram. And if you like cats, people should definitely follow you because cats forever.
Yeah, cats.
this is so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure to chat.
And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening and for being part of the Real Talk Radio family. I couldn't do this without you. And as I said way back at the top of the episode, this is now a 100% listener-supported show. The show is made possible by people like Linda. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
So we are going to play a quick three-question round of Would You Rather, which is my favorite game. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Would you rather be able to control your dreams so you could dream about whatever you wanted, or not be able to control them, but be able to watch your dreams on video the next day?
Oh my gosh, hands down, number two, for sure. Watch them.
Wouldn't that be so, I feel like sometimes I wake up and I can't even make sense of what my dream was. And if I could just watch it, I would get such an insight into my crazy like subconscious.
Yes. And it's like, we know that trying to describe our dreams to someone else is so boring for them, but we just have to like talk about it because we need someone to hear this craziness that went into our head. So if we could just show them.
Totally. But I feel like you're right. Universally, no one wants to hear about your dreams. Literally no one ever.
No, it's true. But we all do it all the time. Usually to our spouses. So it's usually our poor spouses that get to hear our crazy dreams.
Agreed. Okay, next one. Would you rather never be able to shower again or never be able to taste your food again?
Okay, so I have a caveat for this because I am a bath person. So could I still bathe, or are you just saying like no cleaning of yourself?
I know. I'm like you. I like to ask a lot of follow-up questions. No cleaning of yourself.
Okay. And what was the second choice?
Never be able to taste your food again. Like it all just tastes like nothing.
I would rather not shower in a heartbeat. The idea of not being able to taste food is horrible to me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, sorry to everyone else that I'm going to be disgusting and never take a bath again, but yeah.
Yeah, they make a lot of good wipes and, you know, oils.
Yeah. Agreed, right? Like we can just baby wipes. That's going to be my new plan. Baby wipes and be able to still eat and taste cake. That sounds good.
Easy one. Yeah.
So the last one, would you rather have every inch of your body covered with tattoos or never be able to speak out loud ever again?
Oh my gosh. I I guess the tattoos. Yeah. I mean, that wouldn't be so horrible. It's sort of like not socially unacceptable anymore, but you would just feel weird looking at yourself in the mirror. But to not be able to talk for someone like you and I, it's almost as bad as not tasting food.
I totally agree with you. Although that one's hard. I mean, your whole face, your whole neck, your whole, I mean, covered in tattoo. Ooh, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, that's why this game is fun, right? Because they're all the options are horrible.
Exactly.
I love it. Okay. So why don't you introduce yourself to the rest of the listeners real quick? Tell everyone where you live and one thing you are totally obsessed with right now.
So my name is Linda Tucker. I live in Brea, California. It's a tiny little suburb outside of Anaheim. And I am a holistic, a body positive, health at every size coach. I work one-on-one with women and help them love their bodies again and deal with sort of chronic illnesses. And I'm totally obsessed with Disneyland right now. I work there part-time just for fun because I live here, and it was just Halloween, which is the best time of year, and then it literally goes one day from Halloween to the next day Christmas, like magically overnight. And so I get to go there and work a few days a week and watch people see it snow in Southern California and just be happy, and I love it there.
It's funny, the magical overnight thing just made me think of, I used to work at Williams-Sonoma, and Thanksgiving is obviously like a huge holiday for any store that's like based on kitchen stuff. And the next day, it's like magically all of the holiday decorations, right? Like it becomes, I mean, essentially Christmas in there. And I never used to think about it, like how that happened. I mean, of course people do it, but until I worked there, and then you're like, oh, you're working until 1 or 2 in the morning, being the person who like does that whole change. And I don't know, it's less exciting when you have to do it, but yeah, I like it.
When I was hired, me and this guy were in our like 3-day training together, and he was hired literally as just a window decorator. So that's what he does, is when the park closes, that he comes in night and just does the windows.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff is a whole, I mean, just from my tiny bit of retail experience, the visual merchandising side of things is huge.
Yeah. So I'm obsessed with all things Disney, working there, learning about it. I've only been there for a few months, so I'm still like in my honeymoon phase, learning, seeing seeing Pluto backstage and seeing the princesses come out of their dressing room. It's very magical.
I love it. So you are a member of our Patreon support squad, meaning that you're one of the people that listeners can thank for making the podcast possible, since you make a small and powerful pledge that helps to fund the costs of producing the show each season. So I'd love for you to share why you decided to support the show and maybe one thing you love about being in our community.
I love the Real Talk podcast. I think I stumbled upon it because I was working with Isabel Fox and Duke, and she was on your podcast. That's how I found you. And I just instantly, I love that it's long. It's, you know, 1.5, 2-hour format. So you can really go deep with people. I love that it forces me to take really long walks with my dog. So instead of like a 30-minute, an hour long podcast, I can go out for a long time. And I really love the variety of people you have on. I'm in the health and wellness world, especially in like the body positivity, which you do have a large number of interviews in that realm. But then I learned something new about, you know, like Carrot Quinn was such an amazing interview. She would have never been someone that I would have found on my own. So you introduced me to new ideas and support the ones that I'm already passionate about. So when I heard you were switching over to the Patreon model, I was thrilled because I knew you were being true to who you were, which is your whole point of your podcast, is being real. And I could actually support you in something that hopefully down the road, maybe I could do with my business. So it's building a community of people that can create content that they really believe in.
Well, that's so nice. I'm so flattered. Thank you.
Hello.
Yeah. Isabel's amazing, isn't she?
She's the best. I love
her. And Carrot Quinn as well. It's funny. I'm right now, you know this, being in Patreon, one of the kind of bonus things that I'm doing for you guys for the end of the year is I'm bringing back, you guys all voted on, these were my favorite guests, or this is who I'd love to hear kind of hear from again. And we're doing some shorter end of year recap episodes. So I'm working on getting those guests lined up. But yeah, Isabel and Carrot were both on the list of people that our community was like, wait, talk to them again. I need to know more. So that's fun.
Yeah, that's great.
And I'm so glad that you were brave and joined me for this. So thank you for that.
Thanks for having me. It was very fun.
And to everyone listening, if you love the podcast, if you want over 20 hours of bonus content, and if you want to help us reach the funding goal we need to hit in order to keep the show going beyond the end of 2016, so beyond the end of this season, just go to patreon.com/NicoleAntoinette to make your pledge of $8 or more for each 8-episode season. I can't tell you how much your support means to me, and I can't wait to get to know you better behind the scenes in our community. So until next time, here's a big virtual hug and a reminder that we're all just doing the best we can, and no matter what, we're in this together.